Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. This week, it's an eclectic musical mix with Poetry Slam, Care Off at the Keyboard, plus a nod to some of the unsung heroes behind the music making as well. We begin with the luthier's craft, instrument making traditions of the Blue Ridge, and Bethany Chaffin's conversation with Executive Director of the Mount Airy Museum of Regional History, Matt Edwards. Then it's time for Spoken Word with some of the Triad's most talented young poets. Greensboro's Poetry Project is thriving, and they're strutting their stuff at an international event in Chicago this weekend. Care Off is back at the keyboard with a look at a 19th century American classic, and the Carolina Summer Music Festival and Rinalda House are showcasing a North Carolina contemporary composer who calls Winston-Salem home next after this news. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. The Mount Airy Museum of Regional History is currently showing the exhibit The Luthier's Craft, Instrument-Making Traditions of the Blue Ridge. In collaborating with renowned regional luthiers such as Wayne Henderson, Audrey Hash Ham, Chris Testerman, and Johnny Gentry, the exhibit focuses on the history of building three instruments, guitar, banjo, and fiddle. You can check out the exhibit during the museum's regular hours, Monday through Saturday, 10 to 5. Visitors can even try their hand at building a banjo in the museum's hands-on section of the exhibit. The Luthier's Craft Instrument-Making Traditions of the Blue Ridge will remain on display through the end of February 2014 before traveling throughout the state. Executive Director of the Mount Airy Museum of Regional History, Matt Edwards, stopped by to chat with Associate Producer Bethany Chaffin.
When we first came up with this idea, we knew the concept that we wanted to work on, but we had only identified just a couple of folks that we really thought we could bring into the process. And so we stepped back and we looked at who were the folks in our community that we knew about doing this. Audrey Hash Ham is an Ashe County native. She's the daughter of Albert Hash, who, as it turns out, really became the center point of the exhibit. In this particular exhibit, in working with these luthiers, all roads led back to Albert some way. But, you know, we reached out to Audrey early on, and she said she was more than happy to work with us in this process. And then we reached out to Wayne Henderson early on, who, as many of your listeners may know, is one of those iconic instrument makers and musicians really from our region. And Wayne is just a phenomenal person to work with. He was as humble and open and easy to work with as you can imagine for this process.
Any anecdotes or kind of things that stick out from collaborating with these people? I know Wayne, from what we saw when he came in, he's a funny guy. He's got some great stories.
He really does. And not to deluge his shop by saying you should all go visit him at his space. But, you know, if you ever have the opportunity to visit Wayne in his workshop, that sense of humor really comes out. It's an amazing process to watch. You know, at some point during the process, he looked at me and says, you know, I think you may have more pictures than anybody who has ever been in here before. And we got to look in, and really we've got probably over 1,000 photos that were taken during the process of Wayne working on the guitar for the exhibit. And you know, the other luthiers that we worked with certainly are documented pretty well approaching that level. You know, in addition to Audrey, who I mentioned, you know, when we talked to her, she said, well, I'm happy to work with you. I said, well, I'd like to talk with you about building a fiddle for the exhibit. And she says, well, I'm pretty much retired from that. She said, but I do have a young man that I'd like to introduce you to. And so part of that story was, and the young man was Chris Testerman, who is the featured luthier in that component. And there's really kind of that mentorship and education component and the idea of passing the tradition from generation to generation, which is really one of the things that we looked at early on. And I mentioned kind of Albert's lead back to Albert. And that's what we found with each of these craftsmen. Audrey obviously learned from Albert Hash, her dad. Wayne Henderson, as a young man, was taken to visit Albert Hash so he could learn how to properly glue up the instrument. Johnny Gentry, who was our banjo maker, was a longtime member of the White Top Mountain Band, which was created by Albert Hash specifically to preserve the music heritage traditions and teach kids in the White Top community to play traditional music. Chris Testerman, who trained under Audrey, was also a member of the program at the Grayson Highland School that was started by Albert and Audrey in the early 80s. It was very interesting for me to see all those roads independently come together and to see really the legacy that one person can leave behind. Really, quite honestly, I think maybe without even realizing what a cornerstone kind of individual they were.
You know, you talk about the traditions being passed on from generation to generation. In building an instrument, is there any such thing as like a family secret or anything that people were kind of a little bit hesitant to say, no, that's kind of, we need to keep that to ourselves? Or was everyone kind of pretty open to share what this process looked like for them?
You know, everybody was really pretty open about things. I think that if you ever work with somebody, you know, there's the old adage that I taught you everything you know, but I didn't teach you everything I know. And I think some of that probably goes on in this particular context. And there are some things that as an outsider, you can look at, but you can never truly understand or duplicate. And the example that I'll give is all of these guys are constantly, as they're shaping the bodies of these instruments, they'll take the components up, and they'll hold them up to their ear, and they'll peck on them. And apparently there's a sound difference that their ear, that they're training, that they know what they're looking for. To me, that pecking sounds pretty much the same on just about any of the pieces. But that fine tuning is really the difference between a truly great sounding instrument and just a piece of wall art. That's, I think, one of the very interesting things about this is that I don't want to say anybody, but just about anybody can put together a great looking instrument. You got some basic woodworking skills and a little bit of artistic ability. You can put together a good looking instrument, but it takes something really special to create a great sounding instrument. And that's what each of these folks have done.
You talk about incorporating some technology into this exhibit, and you already mentioned the hands-on aspect mm-hmm. to what a visitor might be able to experience there. But how about that sound? Are there any audio components?
There are. We've got a push-button audio station that's part of the kind of introductory components where you can come in and sample some of the different types of music. So you can actually hear what these different types of music and really the origins of traditional mountain music come from. And we've got some great video clips. We were able to partner with a couple of the PBS stations, both in North Carolina and Virginia, to pull together some great archival video of Albert Hash, of Audrey Hash Ham, and Wayne Henderson. So we've got some great video components that are incorporated in this as well. The other technology bit that we've really taken to using, not only in this exhibit, but in our museum on a larger scale, is the QR code technology. And, you know, for your listeners, that's those funny little barcode things that everybody talks about scanning with the smartphone. From a museum perspective, those are great interpretive tools. Marketers will tell you they're now passe and nobody's using them. But from an interpretation standpoint, it's a great way for us to be able to provide added content without having to completely reproduce an exhibit. And so some of the things that we've done in this exhibit, you can actually hot link through the QR code to an instructional video on playing the dulcejo, which is a kind of combination of a dulcimer and a banjo. And the creator of this instrument talks about the noting scale in detail in about a 3-minute video that I could never articulate in a text panel in a way that a reader could understand it.
I think that's wonderful, too, because not only does it take into account, you know, say there's a more complex idea or a sound that you're trying to convey that, you know, might not be well adapted to text. You know, people have different learning styles when mm-hmm. they go to a museum. And so something like that, it sounds like it might cater to all sorts of ways in which people absorb information. So.
Absolutely. And, you know, with the younger generations, as much as I hate to say it, technology is going to be the way to go. And so we have to find ways to utilize what I would call emerging technologies.
Is there anything coming up while the exhibit is still with you all that you would kind of send listeners to as a nice tie-in?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's the great thing about this type of exhibit is there's so many opportunities for programming moving forward. The second Saturday in November, we're actually hosting a cigar box guitar building and playing workshop. We'll be working with Mike Lowe, who's a pretty well-known local storyteller, musician, historic interpreter, kind of jack of all the artist trades. He's going to be doing the workshop with us. That's one of the components that was built into the guitar section, is that kind of idea of folks creating their own music and this extending back quite a long ways. And so we talk about that idea of the cigar box guitar. And we actually have that's one of our hands-on components in the guitar section, is there's a cigar box guitar that you can pull down off the exhibit and try your hand at picking a few notes on that there. Yeah, we talked about the ability to create a great sounding instrument, but I think that probably doesn't do justice to the craftsmanship and the artistry that goes into these things. And each of these luthiers really are remarkable craftspeople. Chris Testerman, the fiddle maker, is an amazing artist in any number of realms. He incorporates a variant of French pointillism for the arty types out there, basically, that was passed down from Albert Hash, who I'm fairly certain didn't have a clue what French pointillism was. But essentially, he covers a section of the instrument in graphite and then uses a nail to puncture and essentially tattoo the design into the wood, and then finishes over it, so that when you're done, you've got this image that's ingrained into the wood as part of the
art on art,
exactly. And you know, he incorporates the wood carving tradition into the scroll work on those things. Everybody has a little something, a little trick, a little something new and different. I was up at Wayne's shop a few weeks ago, touching base and visiting, and I was watching him, what they call the kerfling. It's the little bracing on the inside of the guitar. And where that bracing attaches to the cross bracing, he was whittling out razor-thin points of bracing material and at the intersection of those things, putting this stuff in place, gluing it in place, and then cutting it off flush and smooth. And I looked at him and I said, so I'm guessing that's a level of detail you're never going to see in a production guitar. And he just kind of looked up and smiled and nodded. You know, that's the kind of thing that it's an incredibly small detail that, unless you know how and where to look for it, most people will never know exists in the amount of detail that goes into it. But it really goes into the creation of a remarkable heirloom quality type instrument.
Executive Director of the Mount Airy Museum of Regional History, Matt Edwards. He spoke with Associate Producer Bethany Chafin. On August 21st, the museum will be partnering with local ukulele player George Smith for a concert, Mount Airy Ukulele Invasion, at the Old North State Winery. All ages are welcome, and there's no cover. At the event, Edwards and the museum will unveil the new ukulele that Jane Henderson, daughter of Wayne Henderson, made specifically for the Luthiers exhibit. You can see the exhibit during the museum's regular hours, Monday through Friday, 10 to 5. Find out more at our website, wfdd.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and after the short break, we've got Dynamic Poetry with Josephus and his team of Young Poetry Project artists, just ahead of their trip to Chicago's 16th annual Brave New Voices International Poetry Festival. Then Karoff makes music with 19th century American Edward McDowell, ahead of 21st century composer Kenneth Frizzell and his Wildflowers, mezzo-soprano Janine Hawley and pianist Robert Rocco, live at Rinalda House. It's a bouquet of music, next, when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford.
The Poetry Project is an organization that prides itself in using poetry
to teach, inspire, and build the communities that we call home.
Through structured workshops, poetry slams, and open mics,
we create a safe space to share our lives and tell our stories.
I'm Trey.
I'm Micah.
And I'm Jada.
And we are the Poetry Project.
For the third year in a row, the Poetry Project is sponsoring the Gate City Youth Slam team as they prepare to go to Chicago for the 16th annual Brave New Voices Poetry Festival. Brave New Voices is an international poetry festival for teens, and this year it takes place August 7th through the 11th. The Greensboro-based Poetry Project uses poetry to teach, inspire, and build community through workshops, slam, and open mics. At the Greensboro Cultural Arts Center, I caught up with Josephus of the Poetry Project and three of his students who will represent Greensboro at the Brave New Voices Festival, Trey Gass, Micah Romans, and Jada Bryan.
At first, they trick us because they tell us, like, you got to be a part of the slam, you got to do these really good poems. And then you get there, and it's so much more than that. It's hard to describe the experience. It's just new, and it's opening, and it's freeing. Because you realize, like, at BNV, you connect with people on a deeper level than just the surface. It's more than just about the poetry. It's about connecting with people. It's about people in general, community. And I think that's the biggest thing that I've learned the 1 year that I went before, is it's not even about the poetry. Like, we're all good with words, but that doesn't matter where we're there. What matters when we're there is what we do to help each other.
Josephus, just put us on the ground there in Chicago. Now, a new venue, of course. You were in San Francisco last year, but besides, there are workshops, there are things going on. Could you kind of describe the scene, you know, fill in the lines for us?
We stayed in Berkeley, California last year. California was very sunny, and we walked up this steep hill for about a mile and a half, the top of what felt like a mountain. And on the top of this mountain was our Mecca. Our Mecca for the week was a college campus that just housed 500 students from all over the place. And when you walk in, you see people hugging and high-fiving and, you know, teams representing and shouting their chants. And everybody was just so excited to be there. You know, once you get your stuff situated, there's opening ceremony where they have every team gets a flag or a banner with their name on it. And so you have this huge processional of 500 youth, each of them representing a different city, state, or country, that march into this circle of life, love, and words. And you see these signs with Greensboro and Asheville and Bermuda and South Africa and Guam and Miami and Philadelphia. And everybody's just so proud and happy to be there and ready to show each other what they have to offer for that week. And like I said, that's just the beginning.
And maybe, Jada, you could throw us something that you picked up along the way that you kept with you, or maybe that affected the way you approach this art form.
Okay, so we went to this workshop by John Survivor Blake, and he said, as artists, people think you should be able to write about anything, and that's wrong. You're supposed to be able to write about everything. And that's something that, like, the idea, the concept, I was like, oh, that sounds really dope. You know, I gave it some snaps, and I was like, oh, that sounds really cool. But when you leave and you start writing, it clicks. Like, I don't have to just write anything. I can write about everything, and my options are limitless. So, like, certain things that you learn in the workshops and certain ideas that you've never even thought of, they sometimes, for me, it doesn't hit me right then. It hits me later on. So right then at the workshops, you know, some of the stuff I'm writing it down, I'm like, okay, that sounds really nice and the words sound cool. But when you get there, it's like the lessons that stick with you as a writer. And, like, it makes you mature. When you're young, that pavement just seems to stretch on to forever. Your life gets caught up between street lights and cracked up cement. It's funny, because no matter how hard you try to skip over those cracks, you still seem to one day hurt that one person that you once shared your heartbeat with. Still, we walk. Treating our feet like a commodity, we live our life through the lines on our hands, never knowing that the smiles on our faces are just our walking obituaries, never telling our full story, just some old throw-together broken lines, those obituaries.
Micah, how about something that, and were there any performances that blew you away that you thought, hey, I want to incorporate some of that into the way I approach it, or what did you get out of the experience?
As far as performance, just about every time someone stepped up on stage, it made you want to be better as a poet and as a writer and as a performer and as a person, really. One thing that really stuck out to me were the side activities that we would do. Like Josephus said, it was 400 to 500 teams. We all got on this train, all got on the BART, and we rode down to Oakland. And when we got off, we didn't know what we were about to do. They just started handing everybody chalk. And then we just got to write on the sidewalks things that we thought, our favorite lines from our poems, things that we think, a way we think that the world should change. And this is for people who are walking around Oakland. They're looking and they're seeing people from ages 13 to 19. It's like, why are all these kids writing on the sidewalk? Then they came up and saw what we were drawing. People were taking the pictures and talking to the poets and really learning about what it was we were doing. And a big thing at BNV is the community. Like they teach you how to not just come together at a central location like Chicago or San Francisco, but how to take these things back to your community and how to better your community at home. So that really hit me in right in the heart. So. My voice has been cracking since the seventh grade. It still does sometimes. I'm used to the shock on people's faces when they hear the bass, yet with all this auditory power, it still surprises me when I'm misunderstood. I feel like I'm on a different wavelength. And then I read an article not too long ago. Baleen whales can only communicate in between the frequencies of 12 and 25 hertz. In 2004, the New York Times wrote an article about a whale whose voice was recorded at 52 hertz. Now, at best, that's a 27 hertz difference. It must be lonely to scream at the top of your lungs and still not be heard by anybody. It's the saddest song.
Trey, how about you? Was there anything, just in terms of the craft of what you do, the art form, the written spoken word that you picked up from either a performance or an activity or workshop? I'd be curious to hear it.
I know one thing that I learned from a team from Philadelphia is like about performance and the art of like going in and like embodying the piece. There was this one piece from a girl from Philadelphia. I forgot her name, but it was a piece on Tourette's. And she didn't have Tourette's. Yeah, Sharmira. She didn't have Tourette's at all, but the way she performed it, like she cussed in the piece, and every time she cussed, like I felt it in my spine. Like my spine literally tingled every time she cussed. Because, like, she felt the piece and she embodied every part of the piece. And when she got done with the piece, she almost fell off the stage because she had put so much of herself into it. And I think that's what I learned. Before I went to BNV, I didn't think it was possible. I thought it was like, all right, I'm going to go up here and I'm going to perform these words and it's going to be really nice and I'm going to do it really energetically. But I realized it's like a deeper place you can go to where you really are embodying the piece and you are the poem. And it's not you up there, it's your words.
I was born into a family of bedtime stories. Before I met my grandmother, I heard she was a dragon. I can still see the burns on my father's soul through his smiles most days. They stand out more than his brands do. I think he has an addiction to the feeling you get letting a piece of you die. Or at least he's grown accustomed to it over the years, but don't we all? Don't we all look for truth at the bottom of liquor bottles, hide behind weed smoke and coke mirrors, fall in love with spilled milk hips and caution sign thighs? I never said these bedtime stories had a happy ending, y'all. My sister has a cracked halo smile that fell straight from heaven. I don't quite remember the day she was born, but I do remember all of the happy memories every time I touched the place they got clipped from. She's an angel waiting to fly, a blessing waiting to be prayed for. I pray I could go back in time and give her wings. I pray she doesn't grow up as fast as her brother did, that she doesn't have to hand her heart to someone in a body bag because the pieces, they just don't fit together anymore. But some prayers just aren't meant to be answered anyway. I never said that I had happy bedside prayers. My mother is nothing short of the Holy Ghost, a wind spirit with church fan lips. I hear her voice through my AC vent on Sunday morning. She says, "Trey, where's your Bible? Trey, why you got those church pants I bought you on the floor? Don't you have any respect? I remember the mornings when she threw leather tornadoes at my backside to break my temple. She broke my temple to show me that being a mosaic is just as beautiful as being a painting, because being broken is beautiful. To show me that we shatter the ones we love, to show them we're going to be there to piece them back together, that our God can piece anyone back together. But be careful what you ask for, because some things are just meant to be broken. That sometimes the only things you have are bedtime stories."
That speaks to me, this whole idea of vulnerability, Josephus. You've got to put it out there. Sometimes it can't be easy to do that. What's that experience like, maybe on the day when you don't want to do that, but you got to go there?
They don't ever want to do it, first of all. So they don't ever want to do it, but it's not about you all the time. You know, there's so many things that we do here in the community to prepare for the festival. And the Poetry Project itself, you know, teaches workshops every Monday and Wednesday here in Greensboro. The youth this summer taught workshops at Black Child Development every Monday to other youth. So it's important that they get a chance to not only hone their skills, but teach other people you know, what they have to offer. The 50 teams that are invited by Brave New Voices every year are teams that are doing things in their community. So that's what's always about more than just a slam. You don't get invited unless you're actually a part of the community doing something, changing something, building something. And these youth talk a lot about their experience there, but they do a lot all year round before we even get there. You know, BMV is only once a year, but the Poetry Project is every day, all day, 24/7. And that's what is the foundation for the slam team. And vulnerability is everything, you know, because you truly want people to see who you are. And for those 3 minutes and 30 seconds on stage, you have a chance to tell the world your story. You know, my man Crossword says there's two ways to have your story told. One is by yourself, and the other is by someone else. Which one do you choose? You know, so daily we have opportunity to choose to tell our own stories and give them the chance. Do you have to do it, or do you go all the way in?
That was Trey Gass, Micah Romans, and Jada Bryan, three members of the Gate City Youth Slam team. I also spoke with poet-educator Josephus of the Poetry Project. The Poetry Project is sponsoring a team for the third year in a row to travel to the 16th annual Brave New Voices Poetry Festival. The International Festival takes place this week in Chicago. You can learn more about Josephus and the Gate City Youth Slam team and watch a video of one of their performances at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. After the short break, we shift gears with 20th century art songs, 21st century piano works, all in the name of nature. Peter Karoff brings us from 19th century composer Edward McDowell to making music at Rinalda House. It's a bouquet of music, live and studio A, next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and this is Karoff at the Keyboard.
Today I'd like to share with you a composer that's a little less known, perhaps, than Bach or Beethoven, and that is the American composer Edward McDowell. Never heard of Edward McDowell? He was considered the greatest American composer around the end of the 19th century, so he was very active in, say, 1890s and into the beginning of the 20th century. Like so many American composers back then, he went off to Europe to study. He studied in Paris, and he studied in Frankfurt in Germany. He even played for the great Franz Liszt. And in fact, through much of McDowell's life, he was known as the American Liszt. McDowell was a brilliant pianist as well as a great composer, and a composer of great tenderness and a great expression. If you know McDowell's music, you probably know the piece I'm about to play. It's called To a Wild Rose. It's from a set of little piano pieces called Woodland Sketches. Sweet. But there's much, much more to McDowell's music than small miniature-type pieces for the piano. After all, he was known as the American Liszt, so it makes sense that some of his pieces would be quite challenging and quite difficult. Here's a piece from a set of etudes that he composed in 1894. It's simply called Impromptu, but It sounds to me a little bit like Flight of the Bumblebee. So you can see the way McDowell is using the keyboard here is much more challenging and much more demanding from the pianist than the sweet and simple little To a Wild Rose. Another piece I'd like to play for you is from the same set of etudes. This one is entitled March Wind, and in it you can hear this kind of Listian use of the keyboard, very challenging, very pianistic, and again, trying to evoke scenes in your mind, in this case not of a wild rose, but of a wind whipping and whistling through the woods. Practically feel the wind blowing around you as you hear this music. All three of these pieces, different examples of Edward McDowell's genius, all three of them you'll notice evoking a kind of visual imagery, especially images of nature, not untypical of composers in the United States at the end of the 19th century. Edward McDowell.
That's Wake Forest University professor and Steinway artist Peter Karoff at the keyboard. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and last week I got a chance to experience a new phase in the Rinalda House experience. They're never standing still over there, until now. Coming up August 10th through December 8th in the Mary and Charlie Babcock Wing Gallery, Rinalda House Museum of American Art presents Things Wondrous and Humble, American Still Life. The exhibition features some of the finest examples of still life. It's a bountiful exploration of one of art's most popular genres and how the everyday objects depicted within it continue to capture our imagination in both traditional ways and music. One of the most traditional still life subjects throughout the ages has been flowers, and the Carolina Summer Music Festival, in collaboration with Rinalda House, is bringing a bouquet of music to the Babcock Wing Auditorium at Rinalda Sunday afternoon, August 18th at 3 o'clock. Renowned composer and UNCSA professor Kenneth Frizzell's Wild Flowers for Piano will be performed by Ivan Singh, and mezzo-soprano Janine Hawley will be joined in performance by pianist Robert Rocco. This week I caught up with the composer and performers on stage. In Rinalda House Museum of American Art in the Charles and Mary Babcock Wing, and it's really a nice little space. And Ken, let's start with Flame Azalea. I love that piece. At moments I want to laugh out loud, but it's also, I know it's not easy to play. So how do you know how much tango-like
material to include without sounding derivative. I mean, it just sounds perfectly natural in your capable hands there.
Oh, that's very nice. Thank you. Well, it's got some quirks in it. There, I leave out some measures of, so there's 7-bar phrases rather than 8-bar phrases, which would be easier to dance to. And there are definitely some wrong notes that are actually written in to make it sound a little bit offbeat and kind of quirky. I was just thinking really about the outrageous color of the flame azalea, which comes in before the sort of pink and white azaleas. It really is an Appalachian wildflower, and it just has this really gorgeous but kind of shocking orangish color. And so I thought a tango would be a perfect way to kind of spice it up, you know.
You sure spice it up with that. I know that you're a nature lover, and you know, you do watercolors of these beautiful scapes out in your place in Virginia. But how did this idea of approaching the wildflower as a source for music come to you? And do you remember when that happened?
I do. I had a friend who was turning 50, and she has this beautiful curly hair that has a little bit of gray in it, and so there's sort of silver ringlets. Okay. And there's this gorgeous, rather rare orchid that I found in our backyard up in the mountains called Slender Lady's Tresses. And it looks like a single blade of grass that has dozens and dozens of tiny white cup-like flowers that sort of spiral around it. And I thought, oh, that would be really interesting to write a piece that had that kind of spiraling motion. And I connected it immediately with my friend Lisa's hair. Oh, that'll make a nice 50th birthday present. So I didn't really sit down and say, I'm going to write a set of flower pieces. They just kind of sprang from that. And then our dear friends, Jonathan and Carrie, had a son. And so I wrote a lullaby. The Deptford Pink actually was a lullaby for Owen. So before I knew it, I had 10 pieces. And then I had a wonderful commission from Rinalda House to premiere a giant piano piece in this very hall that we're in right now. And so the wildflowers became part of a larger piece called Sonata Fantasy. So it all started right here.
When you're compiling several different works or maybe written at different times, did you begin with this notion of eventually these are going to come together with a larger work, or did it just happen that way?
I probably had in the back of my mind that it might become a set. I like sets of piano pieces or sort of character pieces, like Schumann wrote some incredible sets of pieces, the scenes from childhood. And I have written other things, like I wrote a set of pieces called Lullabies and Bird Songs years ago that actually started out as little anniversary presents and wedding presents and that kind of thing. So I like the power of putting little things together into bigger sets and seeing what happens. And it's really fun to arrange them too and figure out what kind of shape you can make when you put all these flowers together.
This next movement, the Deptford Pink that you're going to play, where does that fall in the cycle?
It's the very last one, and I wanted it to end. Some of them get very savage. They're not all pretty. And it's funny to me, sometimes critics talk about the pastel shades of the wildflowers, and I'm thinking, well, you weren't listening to number 3, 7, 8, and 9 then, were you? Because some of them get very raw and kind of savage. I mean, I'm trying to put the wild in wildflowers, you know?
But putting the wild in wildflowers, Ken Frizzell.
Oh, well, I wanted it to end in a very quiet, sort of pastoral, sleep-like place. So it kind of drifts off at the end.
Well, let's hear this. From Sonata Fantasy, the second movement, Wildflowers, by Kenneth Frizzell. And we're going to hear Deptford Pink.
Thank you.
Okay, Ken, I've got to confess. I heard this, yeah, here in Rinola House. How long ago was that?
I think it was 2005, which is hard to believe.
I wept like a baby when this movement came out. It's got to be one of the most beautiful, seemingly simple, but most beautiful melodies in the construction of that. There's such an interest going on within that. What is it about that figure that drew you as a composer? Kind of you gravitated toward that.
Again, it came from the flower. The Deptford pink is in the pink or the carnation family, and it's tiny. It's a tiny, five-petaled, deep fuchsia color flower, and it has teeny little silver dots on it that almost look metallic. And so I wanted something very delicate, and I thought of just these sort of single floating notes on the piano that just almost like dots. The notes are almost like beautiful little dots. And it's not that it's a great soaring melody or anything. It's more that the ear connects the dots and finds a kind of childlike simplicity or a kind of melodic shape that's suggested, I think.
Is there a piece that you would spout off the top of your head that draws you in at that same sort of way?
There's so many small pieces that I think are as powerful as any giant piece. I mean, there's a gorgeous little piece by Bartok and a group of pieces. It's not the Microcosmos, but he wrote another little piano book called For Children. And there's this beautiful little, almost like a swinging boat song, very gentle piece that just, it's one of the most perfect moments in music. And certainly almost every note of the Schumann scenes from childhood has that kind of intimacy and power. I mean, I really do think that some of the greatest moments in music are just these glimpses, or some of the Chopin preludes are no more than 20 or 30 seconds long. So I really relish brevity.
Compositionally speaking, is that as challenging or more so than writing a large piece for orchestra, or is it just two apples and oranges?
For me, it's all hard for different reasons. I mean, I think when you're writing something very short, every single note, every single marking has to be just as good as you can make it. And you're dealing with a very different time world, of course. When you write a big piece, you have a chance to let it unfold over, you know, larger stretches of time. And I think it's probably more difficult to write short pieces for me.
Janine and Robert, what a treat. Little private recital here at Rinola House. And I've never been in here without lots of seats. It's a pretty live hall. How did it sound up on stage?
Wonderful. You get a lot back.
I wanted to ask you this, if just from a purely performance perspective, what's it feel like to fill up a whole
hall of sound and have that kind of control. When it's going good, what's that feeling like? It's some of those maybe forte moments in that piece.
I guess soaring is the word that comes to mind first.
Yeah, it feels like that. I mean, I really felt like I was on a journey there. And this song, it gives you the best of such an emotional swing from just folly to moments of little drama and everything between. There's a lot in there. How was it from a performance perspective in terms of really approaching it? It's not Schubert Lieder, but what is it? How is it? Where does it fall?
Well, there are so many variables in the way that he approaches the text. He sets it in a simple, you know, kind of Schubert-like way in the very beginning, and then it gets this real delicate grazioso feeling, you know, and then it goes to this great sustained prayer-like Bach hymn almost, you know, in the middle, and then goes back to the delicate place. And so it's just got so many flavors, I guess.
Robert, when you're accompanying voice, what does it do to you as a collaborative artist in that scenario, in terms of your playing, in terms of considerations that you might not be thinking if you were accompanying maybe a clarinetist, say, or something?
Well, the voice is just such a special instrument, and I like to collaborate with it in the sense of also being part of the singing. So I like to make the piano sing and kind of weave in and out with what the vocalist is doing. And this piece is great for that. It has sort of a nice introduction, kind of a fanfare introduction, and then that introduces the singer. And then in the middle, there's kind of a dance-like connector, sort of Renaissance sounding. And, you know, that just sets up all the sections very beautifully. So it's kind of like I'm part of that, too. It's almost like being in a theatrical kind of performance, but through music and through instruments.
He helps me soar.
Well, together, it was a beautiful combination. It really was. Give us an example, Robert, of how do you get that legato playing at the extent where you feel like you're really singing on the piano?
Well, it has to do with what we call voicing, what every piano student has to learn at some point. And that's usually to bring out the top voice and let the bass and the middle voices have their say but not get in the way, so that you can make a connecting line but still have the nice harmonies kind of supporting the musical action and thought. And for me, that was not as easy as it may have sounded when teachers explained it to me. I sort of had to find that, and through practice and through growing. And I also do love to sing. I sing chorally, and I work with singers. And so eventually those things kind of informed my playing as well. But I look for the clues and the cues in the music that would invite that kind of thought. And that's my green light, so to speak, to help the singer achieve what she's trying to do as well.
Do we know anything about Mr. Hundley? What this composer's new to me.
I actually had the good fortune of meeting him in New York. I was singing a concert at Trinity Church down on Wall Street, and I was singing some of his pieces, and my agent invited him to come, and so he came, and since then we have had a nice relationship, and he sends me his pieces in different keys if I want them, because a lot of them written for soprano. And I said, I love this piece. So he says, oh yeah, I can put it in a different key for you. And so he's just really, really great, and he loves singers. He was an accompanist at Juilliard for many years, and so he loves singers and loves the voice and really knows how to set it.
There are certain composers with whom singers like to collaborate, and they get a lot of work. What is it you're listening for as the singer, as a vocalist, that draws you to his music? I'm sure we touched on some of it before, but specifically as a performer considering a work like this or others in his catalog.
The way that he sets the text and the colors that he creates in the harmonies, and also even in the rhythmic structure and the articulation, the way that he sets the text, I think, is always really spoken to me.
It does sound natural in the audience. There's nothing forced about it. I can't describe it. When I'm in the audience, I don't know much about dance. But when I see a company that's in tune or on the same page or linked in whatever way it is, I can perceive it. I think people in the audience perceive that, and it just adds to the enjoyment of the performance. I'm getting a really similar vibe watching the two of you work together. What's it like working with Robert?
Well, I love the way he plays, because he knows when to play with what I call fat fingers, in terms of really knows when to give me the support that I need in certain areas of the voice, in terms of, you know, the middle is more meaty in my voice, and he knows to play with fat fingers then. And then he knows when to have the delicate touch, you know, and to lighten up when I'm up in the top. And so I just love the way that he does that.
My mother.
renowned composer and UNCSA professor Kenneth Frizzell, mezzo-soprano Jeanine Hawley, and pianist Robert Rocco. I spoke with them at the Babcock Wing Auditorium of Rinola House Museum of American Art. The exhibition, Things Wondrous and Humble, American Still Life, opens to the public at 9:30 a.m. Saturday morning, August 10th, in the Mary and Charlie Babcock Wing Gallery. And coming up on Sunday, August 18th at 3, the Carolina Summer Music Festival presents a still life exhibit of their own. A Bouquet of Music, a chamber recital featuring music inspired by nature and flowers, and all things wondrous and humble, including Kenneth Frizzell's piano work, Wildflowers, performed by Ivan Singh, and performances by Jeanine and Robert. I'll be moderating a Q&A with the composer and performers immediately following the performance. You'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. That's all for today's show. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia. Our associate producer is Bethany Chapin. And our intern is Kathleen Coker. Please send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.